long 36-year career at Boston University before moving in 2014 to become a faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute, where he is now. He is very hard to summarize, but you know, he won the 2021 Kadnoff Prize at the American Physical Society for his contributions to statistical physics. But that doesn't really do it justice. I was just going to read a couple titles from his most recent papers. There's one, Birds on a Wire, about this model of the statistical distribution of birds on a wire. How smart should a forager be? How soon will the elevator arrive? this sort of subsample, I encourage you to look at the most recent 20. That's a better way to get a sense. But anyway, he's an expert on non-equilibrium statistical physics, and in particular on so-called first passage processes, which are ubiquitous and beautiful, and which he'll introduce us to today.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Very nice to be here. Very nice to see most of you from my class this morning.
So the work I'm going to tell you about is, first of all, the first like sort of half of this talk is going to be just introductory material about what is a first passage process. And then the second half, I'll be discussing some collaborative work. And my collaborators, Danny Ben-Avraham, Paul Karpiewski, Benjamin De Bruyn, who was actually a student here at PSI in 2019. And contacted me out of the blue, and somehow we started working on some research together, and that's something I'll tell you about today. And also Julian Randon-Furling, and of course, in the United States, you can't get away without saying, and NSF support. So I'm grateful for their support financially. Okay, so here is what I'm gonna talk about today. First, I'm gonna tell you, what is the first passage process? If you don't know what it is, hopefully at least you'll know that at the end of the talk. And then why should we care about what the heck they are? And then I'll go and discuss some very simple consequences of first passage processes, namely, well, not consequences, but some basic theory of it, which is the first passage process in one dimension, and then discuss like two natural scenarios about first passage, which is like when you have a finite interval, how long does it take for a random walker to get out of that interval? And then I'd like to present a very beautiful connection between first passage processes and harmonic analysis. Harmonic analysis is a fancy word for electrostatics. There's a beautiful connection between first passage and electrostatics. And then I will discuss two applications. One is the problem of stochastic hunting in one dimension, which I think you'll find fun. And then finally, the dynamics of wealth sharing. And for anyone who's a poor graduate student, like I was when I first went to grad school, this is actually kind of relevant. Okay, so first of all, what is a first passage process? So imagine that you start with a random walker at the origin. And so the random walker walks, he's doing a random walk, hopping to the left, to the right, randomly. And let me phrase this in a way that for most of the audience, you'll have to worry about this maybe 25 years from now, which is your kid graduates from high school and you send them off to the world. And your kid being a free spirit just sort of randomly looks at what all the opportunities are. And if their state space is a one-dimensional state space, a natural thing you can ask is like, well, where's my kid? So that's sort of basic question. But what's perhaps more relevant for the parent waiting for the kid to come home again to ask for money or ask for the keys to the car is, will you ever see your kid again? And if you do see it, like how long do you have to wait? Will the kid come back after 20 years, 50 years, 10,000 years? And so these two questions of will you ever return to the starting point? How long does it take to return to the starting point? These embody what is a first passage process. So this simple thing defines a very simple first passage process in one dimension. Okay, and so why should we care about something like this? And you know, here's some sort of de rigueur applications. In the brain, we have integrate and fire neurons, and there's a fluctuating voltage level. When the voltage level first reaches a critical value, the neuron fires and sends signals to neighboring neurons. And basically, the thought process is just this integrate and fire neurons firing and sending signals to other neurons going on and on forever. So like integrate and fire neurons, thinking in the brain is sort of repeated first passage processes. Another example is stock options. You know, maybe most of us in this room don't have enough money to think about stock options, but some people actually think about buying and selling stock they don't own. And so stock options are a thing where you have a contract to either buy a stock when it first reaches a given price at a certain time, or to sell a stock when it first reaches a given price at a given time. And so people make a lot of money with stock options. Diffusion controlled reactions. So if you have like processes in which diffusion is the rate limiting step to bringing chemical reactants together, but when they meet, they react right away. Well, that's a diffusion controlled reaction, and it's governed by a first passage process when two reactants come together. And I'll show you an example of a stochastic search process later on in this talk. Anyway, so these are some reasons why we should care. So let me now spend a few minutes just showing you as simple can be, the basics of first passage in the one-dimensional setting. So the question I want to ask is, suppose you start with now a random walk, not at the origin, but I start at some initial point x naught, and they ask, when does the random walk first reach the origin? And so what we want to do to solve this problem formally, what we want to do is we want to solve the diffusion equation with a particle starting at the origin. But and very importantly, there's a boundary condition, which is that if you hit the origin, you can think of it as a cliff, and the random walker goes over the cliff, and it's gone from the ensemble, because you, once you've gone over the cliff, you don't go over a second time. So for first passage, you just have when you first go over the cliff, that's all that you care about. So this is the problem that we want to solve. But before solving this, let's solve an easier problem. Let's get rid of the boundary condition. So, okay, so these are the things we want to compute. But before we do this, let's solve an easier problem, which is let's forget about the boundary condition. So here we're just solving the good old diffusion equation starting at point x naught. So we all know the solution to that. It's a Gaussian centered at x naught. And now I want to come back to the problem of putting in the boundary condition, which is the cliff at the origin. And so by definition, if there's a cliff at the origin and any random walkers get to the origin, they're immediately removed from the system. That means that the concentration at the origin is zero. And so how can we enforce concentration at the origin equals zero? Well, one way is you can solve this set of equations formally, and you'll find what the answer is. But a more elegant way is to say, well, if I'm having zero boundary condition at the origin, I can use the image method from undergraduate electrostatics. That is that if I put a negative Gaussian at minus x naught, then by symmetry, it's the concentration is exactly equal to zero at the origin. And so this is essentially the same solution as formally solving the system of this equation. And so this is actually our solution. And so our solution is just a sum of the Gaussian centered at x naught and an anti-Gaussian centered at minus x naught. And from this concentration profile, then we can now compute what is the probability of first reaching the origin at any given time. And basically, it's just the flux, the diffusive flux at the origin. And because there's a zero boundary condition at the origin, it means that if you hit the origin, you're gone from the system. So you don't count anybody more than once hitting the origin. So the flux at the origin is exactly our first passage probability if our initial condition is to start with a single particle at some point x naught. So here is my concentration field. I differentiate, and you get this very simple expression for the first passage probability. And so that's the answer. This answer, though, has a lot of interesting implications. And so what I want to now discuss is, like, what is the consequences of this very simple formula? And so here's some basic facts. Basic fact number one is that if you integrate this first passage probability over all time equals one. So you are guaranteed that when you send off your kid into the world after they graduate from high school and they're wandering randomly in a one-dimensional opportunity space, they will certainly come home to ask for the keys to the car. And one other thing is that for the students in the audience, like, it's fun to actually compute this integral. Don't plug it into Mathematica. Just do it analytically. You'll get one. However, if I ask how long do I have to wait, what is the average time before I'm going to see my kid again, this time is infinity. And you can see why it should be infinity, because if I look at this first passage probability, for a long time, the exponential goes to 1. I have a t to the minus 3 halves tail, and the integral dt times t to the minus 3 halves diverges. And so the average time is infinite. So your kid will certainly return home, but you might be dead and gone by the time they come home. But we can then ask, well, what is the typical time? And so, you know, the point here is that because of this long time tail, it's actually controlled by that one wayward child who decides to like go to the moon or something like that and hangs around there for a million years before coming home. The typical kid is actually going to come home after a few days and ask for the keys to the car. And so how do we define the typical time? One natural way of defining the typical time is we take the concentration field and say that when you integrate from some unknown typical position to infinity, when half the concentration is outside the typical range, that defines the typical range. And so if we plug in this concentration field from the previous slide into this integral and do it, we end up with this thing where Fc is the complementary error function. And if we set that equal to this integral equal to 1/2, we get this condition on the error function. We can't solve this analytically, but we can solve it numerically. And the numerical solution gives me this, that the typical position, which starts off at 1, monotonically goes to 0, and it hits 0 at a typical time, which is basically 1.1 diffusion times, which is x naught squared over d. So even though the average time is infinite, the typical is finite. And this dichotomy between certain absorption, infinite average lifetime, finite typical time is what makes random walks still a vital field of research, even after 150 years of activity in this area. So let me now present, like in the sort of framework of like first passage 101, a very simple consequence, which is exit from the interval. So in this example, what I have in mind here is that you go to a casino, you have a certain amount of money in your pocket. The casino has a lot of money in its vaults. And you're playing the casino, and if you reach here, you have all the money. You cleaned out the casino. If you reach here, the casino has cleaned you out. And let's assume, which is certainly a bad assumption, that the casino game is fair, that half the time you're going to win a betting game and half the time you're going to lose a betting game. And then the question I want to ask, if I come to the casino with a certain amount of money, what's the probability I'll clean out the casino or the casino will clean me out? And how long does it take for this event to occur? And so let's try and work this out. And so these are the basic things I want to compute. What is the exit probabilities to either end of the interval? How long does it take to leave the interval? And also you could ask the conditional time, which is the time to reach the one side, and given that you reach one side versus or the time to reach the other side. So these are the basic questions we might be interested in. Okay, so first of all, let's compute the exit probability. So I define this thing E of X, probability of exiting when I'm starting from X and I end up at the right end of the interval. And so formally, this exit probability, I have to sum up over all possible random walk paths that start at X and end at L. And I'm going to use a device which was first invented by Kolmogorov, who is a brilliant probability theorist in two generations back, and it's sometimes called the backward Kolmogorov equations. And it's really the right way to solve this problem. And it's very simple and very physical and very direct. And so his idea was the following, which is that you can write this sum of all paths, the probability of a given path, you can decompose it in the following way, is that here I am, I'm starting, and I want to reach, say, the podium. Well, after the first step, I either step to the left or I step to the right. I guess I'm doing that in your frame of reference. But after that, the process starts over again because it's just a random walk. And so this sum over all paths, half the time I make a path where the first step was to the right. And so I have to sum up over all paths where the first step was to the right. But I have the probability of going from x plus dx, the new starting position, to L. And half the time I made my first step to the left, and then I just have the same sum over paths, but with the starting point x minus dx. That's all there is to it. And so with this picture, one can write this term, the summation is just the exit probability starting at x plus dx. This is the exit probability starting at x minus dx. And so in the continuous limit, one can write this is just like Laplace equation with the boundary conditions that if I'm at the right edge, if I start with all the money in the world, then I've already, the probability of reaching all the money in the world is 1. If I start with no money, then I have no chance of getting any money, and the boundary condition is 0. And so even I can solve this differential equation, very simple. But now let's look at the average time to reach either end of the interval. And again, we can do the same kind of backward Kolmogorov approach to solve this problem and use the renewal structure of diffusion, which is that I say, well, I start from some position x, I want to ask how long does it take for me to get to either end of the interval. I take my first step, and from that new point, I have the time from that new point, but I just have to add the time to dt that I wasted for the very first step. And so, again, formally, I can write the time as a sum over all paths, the probability of a path, times the time of that path that goes from x to either end of the interval. And I decompose it. Half the time I make my first step to the right, and so I have the time starting one step to the right plus the time I wasted in making my very first step times the probability of paths that go from starting from one step to the right to the end, and similarly for the first step to the left. But then each one of these guys is just the time over all over again, but just at a new starting point. So one can write then that this part is just the t of x plus dx, this part is t of x minus dx, and then these two guys conspire to give me the dt, because the time that I waste in the first step, I either step half the time to the right or half the time to the left, the sum of these is just dt. So here's like more pictorially just who combines with what. And so again, this equation, the continuous limit, we can just, you know, expand to second order, and we end up with the Poisson equation with the boundary conditions that I have nobody, the time is zero if I've already started at the ends of the interval. And here the diffusion coefficient is just like the sort of step length squared divided by 2 delta t. And so this has a very simple solution that looks like this. And let's look at the physical meaning of this. So here is this exit time, unconditional exit time, as a function of starting position. And so if I start at either 0 or L, the time will be 0. If I start a distance 1 away from the boundary, this formula will give me a time of 1. If I start halfway across the interval, then the time is of order L squared. I'm sorry, this time here is of, when I'm at distance 1 away from the boundary, the time is order L. In the middle, it's time of order L squared. So this is kind of like another interesting dichotomy of random walks, is normally you think of time scaling like length squared, which it does in the center, but at the boundaries, it doesn't. It has this other scaling. So one more thing is that these are the conditional times. The time t plus is the time to reach the right boundary starting from x, the time to reach the left boundary starting from x. And if you put these on the formula, I didn't derive it. I'm just telling you what the answer is. And so here's the exit times. And so if I start, say, at the left edge, and I want to ask the time it takes to get to the right boundary, it's large if I start at the left boundary. But if I get very close to the right boundary, then the time becomes very small. Okay, so the last thing that I want to say in the framework of sort of simple and general introduction is the connection between good old electrostatics and first passage. And so here's the problem that I want to present, which is, suppose I have an absorbing domain. I start with a random walker somewhere in the domain, and it's going to exit this domain at some point. And I want to ask, what is the probability that it exits at this boundary point R sub b? And how do we solve this problem? Well, let's first of all write down the formal solution to the problem, which is that I want to solve the diffusion equation with a particle that starts at R naught, with the boundary condition that all along the boundary, the probability of being at the boundary is zero. So I can think of this domain as like a high mesa, and I'm random walking along the mesa. And if I hit the boundary of the mesa, I fall off the cliff and die. And then I can ask, where do I die? That's the question I want to ask. And so the thing that we want to compute is the diffusive flux at every single point along the boundary. So that's nothing more than the normal derivative of the probability, and then integrating over all time to get the total probability averaged over all, you know, summed over all time. So that's the problem we want to solve. And if you look at this thing critically, you'll say, geez, this is really stupid. Because here I'm solving an equation with a time derivative. And after I do the time derivative, I come to the end and I integrate over all time. Why not integrate over all time right from the beginning? Doesn't that seem like that might simplify things? So in fact, that's what I'm going to do, which is I'm going to take this original equation and integrate it over all time. And let's now define the time integrated concentration as just the integral over all time of the concentration at every given point in space. And when you do that, black magic happens. And the black magic is that we change the diffusion equation into the Laplace equation with the boundary condition of the concentration, the time integrated concentration of the boundary is zero. This is nothing more than the electrostatic potential with a charged particle at position R naught. And so the thing that we want to compute, the time-integrated flux, is nothing more than the derivative of the electrostatic potential, which is nothing more than the electric field. So you now have solved your favorite first passage problem as an electrostatic equivalent by saying that the exit probability at any given point is nothing more than the electric field at that point on a surface of a grounded conductor with a point charge of a specific magnitude that just matches the Laplace solution to like the diffusion equation solution. And so now you know how to solve lots of cool first passage problems if you just go to your Jackson and look at like your favorite electrostatic problems, like, you know, two grounded planes or a grounded sphere. You can now compute, like, what is the probability that a random walker that starts at some point on the north pole, like a distance r, you know, a distance 10 r from a sphere of radius r, what's the probability it's going to hit anywhere on the surface of the sphere? You just have to look it up in Jackson. So these are kind of very simple but very fundamental aspects of first passage, and I find them very beautiful because, you know, I found electrostatics very beautiful as a graduate student. All right, so what I want to do for the rest of this talk is discuss two applications. These applications are very simple and very generic, and they also illustrate a lot of cool features of the kinds of thinking one does in dealing with diffusive problems in many particle systems. And so the first one I want to present is what I call stochastic hunting in one dimension. So here is our problem. We have a lamb. Our poor little lamb, and this lamb is diffusing in one dimension. And on one side of the lamb is a cluster of lions, a pride of lions. And these lions are not very smart, so they're only diffusing. And the question is, what is the survival probability of one diffusing lamb in the presence of n diffusing and independent lions? And so these sorts of diffusive capture problems, they're all over in the literature, and there's lots of work that's been done on this. And what I want to present to you is our way of looking at the problem. So first of all, it turns out that the lamb probability, so let me define Sn of t, the survival probability of the lamb in the presence of n lions. And factoid is that this survival probability decays as a power law in time with an exponent that depends on n. And so for those of you who are like statistical mechanicians, or even if you're not, probably you've heard the term universal behaviors, universality, scale-independent behaviors. Exponents don't depend on the details of the problem. So this problem is exactly the opposite. It turns out that the exponent depends sensitively on how many lions there actually are. And so the question that we want to compute is, or the thing that we want to compute is this exponent, the survival exponent beta sub n. So that's what I want to focus my attention on. Okay, so let's first of all do this in kind of the most simple-minded way. And for those of us who work in stat mech, you're going to see an important lesson here, which is that solving a one-particle problem is easy. Solving a two-particle problem is hard. Solving a three-particle problem is impossible. But letting n go into infinity, it becomes easy again. And so let's look, first of all, at the easiest problem of one lion hunting one lamb. And so in this case, if this guy's diffusing and this guy's diffusing, it's easy to show that the coordinate between these two guys is also undergoing diffusion, but with a diffusion coefficient, which is the sum of the diffusion coefficients of the lion and the lamb. And for the sake of simplicity here, let me just assume that everybody's diffusing at the same rate. And so because we just have this one coordinate, which is diffusing, when the coordinate reaches zero, that means the lamb is eaten by the lion and dies. But we already know the solution to that problem because we already derived the first passage probability, which went like 1 over t to the 3 halves. And since the first passage probability decayed as 1 over t to the 3 halves, the probability that you survive, which is the integral of the first passage probability from t to infinity, it means that your first passage probability does not hit, you know, you don't hit zero up at time t or larger. That means that you will have survived up to time t. So when you integrate t to the minus 3 halves to infinity, you'll get an exponent, you'll get a power law decay of the survival probability, which goes as t to the minus 1 half. So our survival exponent for one lion and one lamb is beta 1 is 1 half. So that's easy and elementary. Let's now go to 2. Oh, by the way, let me just say, so the lamb certainly dies, but another thing that you might be interested in is how long does it live? So if it surely dies, how long does it take before it dies? And for the same reason that your child takes forever to come back to see you, the same thing here, the lifetime is infinite. Okay, but now let's go to two lions, one lamb. So here is our problem now, coordinates x1, x2, and x3. And what I'm going to do here, it's basically I'm going to solve this by pictures only and essentially no calculation. And the picture, the pictorial way of representing this is you can think of this as three particles on the one-dimensional line, or you can think of it as one particle in three dimensions with coordinates x1, x2, x3, but satisfying certain constraints. So if you look at the problem, we want that this lamb does not get eaten by lion number two or by lion number one, which means that this coordinate has to be bigger than x1, and this coordinate has to be bigger than x3. And notice here that I'm not worrying about the possibility that the lions interchange positions. So I'm assuming that the lions are non-interacting. So when they see each other, they don't bother each other. And so I don't worry about whether x1 crosses x2 or not. So there's no constraint on the coordinates x1 and x2. But now if I think about this problem in a three-dimensional space, I have a random walker with coordinates x1, x2, x3 that satisfy these constraints. So what does that look like? So we have our three-dimensional space, x1, x2, x3. And in order for lion 1 not to hit lamb at 3, I must have that x3 is bigger than x1. So that's a plane in the, here's the x3, x1 axis. So I've got to draw a plane. It doesn't look very planar here, but definitely a plane, which sort of lies at 45 degrees to this axis. And the lamb surviving means that the lamb has to be kind of to the behind this red plane. So that's one constraint. But then there's a second constraint, which is that lion 2 cannot hit the lamb. And so that means there's another plane, x2 equals x3, and the lamb has to be to the left of this blue plane and behind this red plane. And so you see that where the lamb can live is kind of a wedge-shaped region defined by the intersection of these two planes. So that's the allowed region. And this allowed region has an opening angle theta that we're going to have to figure out. And so once we know the shape of this wedge-shaped region, then we can try and solve diffusion in a wedge-shaped region and figure out the answer. But before we do that, we have to figure out what is this angle theta, because that turns out to be crucial. And here is where pictorial analysis really helps a lot. So here is our situation. And for fun, and just for fun, why not put in the other constraint, x1 equals x2, lion 1 and lion 2? And now you see there are three constraint planes, and there's the line 1, 1, 1, where all the particles are at the same point in space. And if you look perpendicular to this axis, 1, 1, 1, then everything becomes really simple, because it's clear that you end up with a symmetrical configuration of these planes. And in order for the lamb to survive, it has to be in this region plus that region, which is two of these wedges. And so that means that my angle is 120 degrees. And so we have to find the survival probability of our particle. We just have to find the survival probability of a diffusing particle in a wedge-shaped region of opening angle 120 degrees. And so here's the problem we want to solve. And now this one, I'm not going to show you how to solve it because it's a well-known classic problem. I mean, I'm happy to derive it privately, but it's a well-known problem. And there is a very famous book by Carl Sloan Jaeger called Heat Conduction in Solids, which is kind of like the analog of Jackson's book in Electrodynamics for the diffusion equation, where he solves the diffusion equation in all geometries you could possibly imagine. And it turns out that this has a very beautiful answer. The survival probability decays as a non-universal exponent that depends on the opening angle of the wedge. And since our opening angle is 120 degrees, we plug that in, and we get t to the minus 3/4 as a survival probability of our lamb. So first point is that, again, the lamb dies, and the lifetime is infinite. But another feature, which is kind of cool, is that you might have said, well, look, for one lion and one lamb, the survival was t to the minus 1/2. The lions are independent, so shouldn't the survival probability be like t to the minus 1/2 squared, because the two lions are independent? And this shows that adding one more lion is not quite the same as independence, because if the lamb hops, both lions in the frame of the lamb will hop in the opposite direction together. So there's an effective correlation between the lions that ends up giving you this exponent 3/4. So clearly we want to add more lions. We want to have more hunters in order that we can get, We want to add more lions. So we could say, well, what about we add 3 lions? What happens then? And here the problem becomes untractable. But let me give you a sense of why it's untractable, which is, so again, we can think of this diffusion in 4-dimensional space. It has all these different constraint planes for all the different pairs of lamb-lion pairs avoiding each other. And we saw that the problem simplified by looking at the plane perpendicular to the 1-1-1 axis, and we had these 6 symmetrical planes. We do the same thing in 4 dimensions. We go to the perpendicular to the 1-1-1-1 axis. That's 4 ones. And now we have 24, 4-factorial wedge-shaped regions, which are called Weyl chambers. And here is my collaborator who actually did this. So here is an experimental realization of that projection of the 4-dimensional space into the 3-dimensional hyperplane. And each one of these planes represents a constraint, xi equals xj. And one such little tiny region like this is what's called a Weyl chamber. And it represents a specific ordering, x1 less than x2 less than x3 less than x4. And the problem that we want is we want x4 bigger than all of these guys, but we don't care about the ordering of these guys. It's 3-factorial orderings of the lines that we don't care about. So it's a union of 3-factorial of these Weyl chambers, which is this. And now it turns out that nobody knows how to solve the diffusion equation in this geometry. Nobody even knows how to solve the Laplace equation in this geometry. So challenge, solve this in that geometry. But what you can do is you can either simulate the problem, or we can use a very beautiful relation between first passage and electrostatics and solve the electrostatic problem, and from that infer the first passage probability. And so it turns out that what we decided to do was actually solve the electrostatics inside of this Weyl chamber, and we infer the exponent beta 3 is 0.913. And if you just do direct simulation, you get the same result, but with a factor 100 bigger error bar, the same amount of computer time represented. Anyways, the point of all of this is that the lamb certainly dies, but its lifetime is still finite. I'm sorry, infinite. So we can ask, well, how do we go to even more? And so when there's more than 4 or more lines, it turns out at that point, the exponent becomes larger than minus or more negative than -1, and the lamb lifetime becomes finite. So that's what happens. That's the answer. But as I said, as I hope you get to see, 1 is easy, 2 is hard, 3 is impossible. So what do we do now? And so let's go to the limit of large n. And in the limit of large n, as I'm going to show you, the problem becomes much simpler. So let's imagine we have like a huge gas, a cloud of lions that are all diffusing. And so here is the world line of the lamb. Here is the world line of the lions. But what we really care about is not all the totality of lions, because the guy who's here in the back, he's not going to reach the lamb. It's a guy in the front. But the guy in the front is always changing who it happens to be. So what we really want is the trajectory union of the last trajectory, or the last lion, which might change its state as we go along. So the issue here is, what is the position of this last or the closest lion? And again, when n is large, it's actually easy to understand what's going on. So what I'm showing you now here is a plot as a function of time. The coordinate of the last lion is a function of time for 4 lions, 64, and 1024. And what you see is that as you add more and more lions, this thing becomes more and more deterministic. So we're going to map the stochastic problem to a deterministic problem, which is this coordinate of this last lion. And how do we find the coordinate of the last lion? It's by a very simple extreme value statistics criterion. And so here, let me show you how to do it, which is, this is the probability distribution of the lions, because they start, they're all doing Gaussian probability, they're all evolving as a Gaussian probability distribution. So if I have n lions, the probability that there's a lion at a position x is equal to the integral of the Gaussian times n, because I start with n of these guys. And so here is now a criterion for where the last lion will happen to be. So this integral from some unknown x last to infinity when there's, if I have n lions, that means this criterion says there's one lion in the range x last to infinity. So this is a very simple extreme value statistics criterion that says how far away is the last lion. And so using that, one finds that if you have a large number of lions, you can estimate this integral asymptotically, and you get that it goes like square root of t, but with an amplitude that grows like log n. That's the new feature here. And you can even do the case of n going to infinity. So if I have like infinite number of lions at one spot, there's an issue with the difference between continuous and discrete, but it doesn't really make sense to put all, you know, infinity number of lions at one point because they're all, it's singular. So a more natural thing is to just say you have like a semi-infinite gas of lions from minus infinity to the origin. And in that case, only a fraction that are within a diffusion distance of the origin are potentially dangerous. And if you plug that effective n into this formula, you get x last that goes like log t times t to the square root. So anyways, now that we have this, the way I'm going to solve this problem is that we're going to say there's a deterministic locus, which is where is the last lion? This is the death line. So if a lamb hits this death line, we say it dies. And so we want to find the survival probability in the presence of this death line. And so this is the only fancy schmancy slide in the talk. I'm just flashing it for fun. So the point is that we have a lamb probability distribution which satisfies the diffusion equation. This term is accounting for the systematic motion of that death line towards the lamb. And then you can do some transformations, and then you can transform to a Schrodinger equation. It's a Schrodinger equation and a harmonic potential. And the lowest energy eigenvalue actually tells you the exponent. And so after a lot of work, some work, you find the exponent, which is for n finite is 1/4 log n. And in the limit, n goes to infinity with our kind of very, you know, sleazy approximation for like how to make n go to infinity, we end up with an exponent that grows logarithmically with time, which means that the survival probability has this weird, you know, e to the minus log squared t decay. And it turns out that this asymptotic agrees with like what fancy schmancy mathematicians do to actually estimate this exponent. So this is, I think, is a very beautiful and simple problem. And it shows like a lot of the techniques that one can do to like deal with many particle diffusion problems. So that's one application. And the second and last application I want to present is a model of altruism by first passage resetting. And so as I mentioned, this is work with Benjamin de Bruijn and Julian Randon Furling. And Benjamin was sitting in this room, you know, 3 years ago, and somehow we ended up working together. And I don't probably have time to say how this problem was inspired by, but if any of you know anything about probability theory, these are two like gods of stochastic processes. And so this, I can tell more about this at another time. But anyways, here is the problem. So this is like a natural application to mathematical finance, which is, let's imagine that the y-axis is how much money you have in your pocket. And here's the time axis. And you know, if you're kind of a poor graduate student, like when I was a poor graduate student, I didn't have very much money. And sometimes I would run out of money before the end of the month. And so imagine now we have a gas of graduate students who are all, you know, they get some money at the beginning of the month. And then they evolve, and like one poor guy or girl goes bankrupt at this time, and the other guy goes bankrupt at another time. So this might be called individualistic dynamics. You get some money at the beginning of the month, your money, like, evolves by diffusion. You know, maybe somebody, you win at gambling, you have to buy groceries, something happens, you go to the laundromat, or maybe you find 10 bucks on the street. So your money is evolving by some random process with no net bias. And then eventually, we know because of one-dimensional diffusion is recurrent, that the probability of returning to the origin or hitting the origin is one. Eventually, one person goes bankrupt, the other person goes bankrupt. So this we know for sure. And now let's suppose that we compare that to the case where the two graduate students here are altruistic. So here we are, and the evolution up to this time t1 is exactly the same as above. But at this point, I go bankrupt. And Latham here, because he's a richer graduate student than I am, I know, I say, could you please lend me some money because I'm bankrupt? And he says, of course, you know, we're all in this together. I'll give you half of my money. So he gives me half of my money, and so we continue to evolve. And then he goes bankrupt, and he comes begging to me and said, well, of course I'll give you half my money because, you know, we're in this together. And so it goes on and on. And so a natural question that you might ask here is, what is the dynamics? What?
Both of you go bankrupt?
You're anticipating me by 10 minutes. So the natural question is, what is the dynamics of this altruistic process? What is the dynamics of this individualistic process? And which strategy is better? And as we're going to see, the notion of better is actually kind of vague. And this is what makes mathematical finance kind of still a very open area, because like, what do you mean by better is not really a well-defined question. Okay, so let's first talk about the individualistic strategy. And so here, it's basically an application of things that I've already shown before, which is that in the individualistic strategies, one guy goes bankrupt, then the second guy necessarily goes bankrupt, and we can figure out the time for each of these events. So let me call phi1 of t, the probability for the first bankruptcy at time t. And in order for somebody to go bankrupt, one of two people to go bankrupt at time t, if both of them are evolving just by pure diffusion, two things have to happen. One guy has to go bankrupt, and the other guy or gal cannot be bankrupt. So this first term is just the probability that somebody goes bankrupt at time t. And this error function is just the integral of the first passage probability from t to infinity, which means that it's the probability that somebody's bankruptcy time is larger than t, which means they're not bankrupt at time t. And so these two quantities conspire to give me the probability that the first bankruptcy occurs at time t. So here again, it's just repeating. One person goes bankrupt at time t. This guy is solvent, has not yet gone bankrupt at time t. And in the long time limit, here's a t to the minus 3 halves tail. This thing has a t to the minus 1 half tail in the long time limit. So asymptotically, this decays as 1 over t squared. So the survival probability is like falling off faster than just one particle, but it's not falling off fast enough such that the average time is finite. So it turns out that the average time you have to wait before both people go bankrupt is still infinite. But now let's look at the second bankruptcy. When does that occur? And so let me call phi 2 the probability for the second bankruptcy at time t. So for that to happen, one guy goes bankrupt at time t, and the other person has already gone bankrupt before time t. And so to go bankrupt before time t, I just have to take 1 minus the probability that it didn't go bankrupt at time t, so that's error function complement. This thing, it goes to 1 in the long time limit. This still has t to the minus 3 halves tail. So this has a broader tail to it than over here. So this is the dynamics of individualism. Everybody goes bankrupt. One can calculate the times for each of these individual bankruptcy events. We know everything about this process. But now let's go to the case of altruism. And let's try and figure out what happens here. And here it's kind of amusing, a little cool. So first of all, let's give a pictorial representation of what's happening. So here is the amount of money for person one, the amount of money for person two. They start, say, each person with $1 in their pocket. And then they evolve by diffusion. So there's some stochastic trajectory. This is a very bad representation of a stochastic trajectory. And somebody, person one, goes bankrupt because person one has $0 and person two has some amount of money. And then person two says, of course, I'll share half of my money with you. And so that means that you move along this, I don't know what you call this line. It's not the diagonal, the anti-diagonal. This corresponds to equal wealth sharing, and you come to this point, and you start all over again. And so we again evolve, and in this case, person two went bankrupt. Person one has money. Notice that in this particular example, when I share the money, I have a little bit more money than what I started. You know, here, the total amount of money was $2. Each person had a dollar. This is less. This is better. So, you know, the total amount of money after each individual bankruptcy event is doing some kind of a stochastic process. And so we can ask, like, how much money happens, is there each time a bankruptcy event occurs? Oh, and by the way, so here's again, it continues on. But now the thing is that in this particular instance, you know, if we don't put in a cutoff, then, you know, this process will go on forever because, you know, we'll keep, you know, hitting the boundary, bouncing here, hitting this boundary, bouncing here. We'll do this bouncing and going on and on forever. But what I'm going to do here is make a criterion for when we define joint bankruptcy. And a natural measure of the joint bankruptcy is just to say that when the total amount of wealth is some fraction, small fraction of the initial wealth, we call that you're both bankrupt. And, you know, that sort of makes perfect sense because suppose that you as a graduate student, well, let me think about my time when I was a graduate student, my first paycheck, $286 a month. And the cheapest thing you could buy at a store was 10 cents. So when I had $300 in my pocket and I lost, like my money went down by a factor of 10, you know, 10 to the minus 3, basically I was worthless because the amount of money I had was worthless. So let me define joint bankruptcy when the total amount of wealth goes down by a factor of 10 to the minus 3. The answers are not going to depend on whether I call it 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. You know, that will make change details, but it won't change the qualitative behavior. So I'll have some cutoff where I define joint bankruptcy. And so now let's ask ourselves, what is the wealth distribution every time I come back to the diagonal? Like every time we share money, how much money do we have after each wealth sharing event? And so what I'm writing down here is the wealth distribution of the solvent agent at the first bankruptcy. And so what is this wealth distribution? And again, because of the simplicity of one-dimensional first passage, we can write down an exact expression for this. So first of all, this quantity here is the probability that you go bankrupt at time t. And this quantity, which is a sum of a Gaussian and an anti-Gaussian, which you may remember from the beginning of the talk, this is the probability distribution of the person who didn't go bankrupt. So this is the amount, this is the probability distribution, the amount of money that the solvent agent has at the time when this guy goes bankrupt. And there's a factor two out in front because either one of the two guys could have gone bankrupt. And then we have to sum up over all possible times that the bankruptcy occurs. And this integral turns out to be elementary enough, and you can do it. And so again, here's just repeating what I just said. This is the probability one person goes bankrupt at time t. This is the amount of money the other person has at the moment of bankruptcy. And then when you do the integral, you get this very nice looking Cauchy-like distribution for the wealth distribution of the solvent agent. And now this wealth distribution has two amazing features to it. First of all, the average amount of wealth equals the initial wealth. It has to be that way, right? I mean, you know, our process of random walking, there's no bias built into it. There's no bias built into when I do the sharing, everything, you know, the money is conserved. So it has to be that the average amount of wealth is strictly conserved. So the fact that it's conserved by doing this calculation, we could have done that without any calculation. It just has to be that way. But, there's always a but here. The typical value of the wealth is going down by a factor of 1 over root 2 every single time. So the point here is that this distribution, if you stare at it, has an x to the minus 3 tail, which means that if the average is 1 or invariant, there's like some contribution of like two lucky people who have hit the jackpot and are millionaires, but most everybody else has got no money and they're just they're living like in the gutter of the street. And so the point is that every single time you do this wealth sharing event, the typical event is you lose a factor 1 over root 2 of your money, even though the average is 0. So, exclamation point. And here's just to show you like that we actually did some work here. Here's a simulation of the process, which is the probability of joint bankruptcy as a function of the number of individual wealth sharing events or as a function of the time of the process. And the point here is that if we start with, say, I think we started with like $1,000 for each person, and we say that if each person gets $1 or less, we call that the end of the process. And it turns out it takes roughly 27 typical events of this type to have the two people be jointly bankrupt. But the number of events to reach joint bankruptcy has this tail to the distribution. So some realizations take 100 bankruptcies, some only a couple of bankruptcies before they've lost all their money. And then as a function of time, we can actually calculate a theory for this, and we have very nice agreement between the empirics and the theory. Okay, so So now there's the final question and the final slide of my talk is like, which is better, altruism or individualism? So let's look as a function of time, the total wealth in the system. And so this is kind of a busy plot, but you know, so I'll go through it slowly. So this is a case of two agents. And so what I'm plotting here in blue and green is the individualist wealth. So when I have two individualists who are just evolving by pure diffusion, on average, if I don't pay any attention to who's who, then you know the average wealth should stay fixed. But if I say one is, you know, one of them dies first and the second dies later, their average wealth has to be fixed. And so what one sees that the first guy goes to zero, and then the second guy, his wealth increases for a while and finally goes to zero. So if I sum up the wealth of the two individualists, which is the black line, it goes down for a while until one guy goes bankrupt. Then the rich guy is actually looking pretty good for a while. It goes up for a while before it goes down again. So that's the evolution of the two individualists. For the two altruists, well, each of the altruists have exactly the same wealth at all times on average by the definition of the process. So here is one altruist, then you add it up, you get two altruists, and you see that at early times, altruism beats individualism, but at late time, individualism wins out. So I ask, which one is better? At early times, altruism is above everybody, so it wins. Out here, individualism wins. So if you're only focused on how much money is in the system, then it's better to be like a, you know, capitalist and say, if you're in the street with no money and you're asking for a buck, I'm going to say, screw you, you know, I want to keep my money. And that's the way that I'll sort of maximize the total wealth of the society. Sounds pretty harsh, doesn't it? One can do the same thing with more agents. And so here is with four agents. So now I'm to make it not as cluttered. I'm just showing the total individualists and the total altruists. At early times, the total altruists win. At late times, the individualist wins. But the crucial point is that here, this is the first bankruptcy of one, two, three. So at this point, there's only one person with money. So it's kind of like Central America. You know, Central American societies typically have this huge underclass of people who have absolutely no money, and then a few people who are just fabulously wealthy. And so the total wealth of the population is better than that of the altruists, but it means that, you know, N minus one people are living in abject poverty, and one person has lots of dough. Here is the same thing for 16 agents, and we can do this for any number of agents. The main message that comes out of here is that at early times, altruism wins, but at late times, individualism wins. So if you're going to use total money as your criterion for which is better, then it's better to be a stinking capitalist, I guess, and just keep your money in your pocket and never share it with anybody. Okay, that's kind of a depressing thought. Anyways, I'm at the end of my talk. So first, hopefully, I've given you a sense that first passage processes, it's a beautiful aspect of the theory of diffusion and random walks. It's a very clean question. It has a very beautiful answer, and it has a lot of interesting consequences. And I showed you very briefly some tools that you can use to understand first passage processes. One of them is the use of this so-called Kolmogorov backward equations, which is just a really beautiful development in probability theory. And I also outlined very briefly the beautiful connection between first passage and electrostatics. And there's many interesting applications. First passage shows up in all kinds of physiology, you know, all kinds of physiology problems. I mean, just think about COVID. You know, a virus enters your body and you want to figure out like when is it going to like attack the cell that actually and get inside the cell to hijack it and start you getting sick. And so there's a lot of problems of like when disease first starts. There's so many other physiological processes that are driven by first passage. In mathematical finance, first passage is everywhere because there's all kinds of futures contracts are all based on first passage. And then stochastic search processes. My example of lions and the lambs was kind of dorky because it was like so idealized. But there's lots of more realistic examples of stochastic search processes for which these ideas are relevant. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. going to.
I guess for the wealth sharing for more than two individuals, when someone goes bankrupt, do they pool their money and divide it by however many there are?
Yes. So in that case, what you do is everybody, it's really, you know, egalitarian. You pool the money and everybody shares it equally. I mean, but one could think of other wealth sharing rules.
Didn't you say that in an individualistic case, the average tenant, you have to wait for them to go bankrupt is infinity?
That's right. The average is true. But the typical is finite.
Yeah, what was the average time for the altruistic case?
It's also infinite. I mean, you know, the point is that if you average over all possible trajectories, it's got to be infinite in both cases. But it's just that, you know, when you're doing finite amount of simulation, you're not seeing like those realizations where the time is even longer than your simulation.
But if you have finite simulation,
right,
simulation, shouldn't you see at the end that maybe in some cases none of them go bankrupt?
It's possible. I mean, typically what you will do if you're doing these sorts of simulations, and this is like a danger thing for people who are first exposed to this problem when there's like a heavy tail, is that you might do, say, I'll do a million realizations, and you'll find like 998,000, you know, 875, they go bankrupt. And there's remaining 125 that don't go bankrupt. Then what do you want to do with them? And so you might ignore them, you might try and do something with them, but they will be there as sort of a thorn in your side. And the thing is that if you try and compute the average time of all the realizations, you'll find that as you make your time longer and longer, so those of those 125 that didn't hit, they will maybe hit after 2 million or after 10 million, but your average time that you measure will actually be an increasing function of your upper cutoff. So there's all kinds of like tricky things you have to be careful of when you're dealing.
So you throw away the 100 and something?
Well, I'm not.
You in general.
No, then you have to think carefully, like how are you going to deal with those bad realizations? Bad, you know, in quotes, because they're actually maybe good realizations, but you've got to deal with them in some way. And so there's tricks to try and deal with that. One of them is to have like your upper cutoff get longer and longer and try and infer some systematic behavior as a function of the upper cutoff. Yes, Emily.
If you took the bankruptcy threshold for to zero,
yeah, so I mean, if you're going to make your bankruptcy threshold zero, then this doesn't make a lot of sense. But the point is that money is quantized in some lowest unit of currency, whether it's a penny or a yen or something. There's some lowest value, and below that point, like that's really the cutoff. And all of these results really didn't depend so much in an organic way on the value of the cutoff as long as it was small.
If you set it completely at zero, isn't the volume zero, so you will never reach there?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, but the point is that that's why you have to have a finite cutoff. But as long as the cutoff is non-zero but small, these results go through. I mean, there might be quantitative difference, but there's no qualitative difference. Yeah.
Is there a general trend for large number of agents, like when you increase the number of agents? From the plots, it seemed like the altruistic curve are like shrinking with respect to the.
Yeah, so the amount of time that altruism wins, the fraction of time that altruism is better, is actually getting smaller relative to the amount of time the individualists are ahead. There was a question in the back.
I'm wondering, since these first passage processes, they depend clearly on the dimensional and the space.
Right.
Introduce
multidimensional money.
So it's not just, you know,
one-dimensional.
You have one, two, three
others, but multidimensional money. Right. Well, so the dimensionality plays a really important role, and in fact, I didn't say anything about the role of dimensionality, but let me just tell you that it turns out that in one and two dimensions, diffusion is what's called recurrent, that it's necessarily returns to a starting point. And the mean time to return to its starting point is infinite. In above two dimensions, random walks or diffusion is transient, which means the probability of returning to its starting point is uncertain. And so that dichotomy between transient and recurrence will show up in some of these financial applications. But typically, you know, I don't know how to sort of formulate a problem where you're going to have like two-dimensional money, because usually all I care about is like, how many dollars in my pocket, but not like maybe how many credit cards versus or and how many dollars. So I'm not sure I know how to formulate an interesting sort of multidimensional financial problem of this type.
Would you also be able to use these methods to model like a sort of closed system where every time someone loses money, someone else gains money?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
I think in that case, the individualism would tend to monopolies and the altruism would lend to similar rates of currency over time.
So, I mean, what you want to do is you want to sort of strictly conserve the money, like sort of step by step. So if somebody goes down by a dollar, somebody else goes up. But then you just have sort of non-interacting gas. I mean, I'm not sure. What question would you ask in a situation like that?
I guess the answer for the average money would still be the same in both cases.
I mean, the thing is that what you're talking about, like in the context of spin systems, you know, in class we talked about Ising-Glauber dynamics, where a single spin can flip. And in that case, on average, a spin up can go to spin down, and a spin down can go to spin up equiprobably. So on average, the spin is conserved, but it's not conserved event by event. But there's something called spin exchange dynamics, where you take two spins that are oppositely oriented, and you do this. And that conserves the spins microscopic step by microscopic step. That has very different dynamics than the single spin flip dynamics. So I imagine there's a similar kind of dichotomy between, you know, the financial model where there's strict conservation each step versus average conservation. You had a question.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask, are there some interesting universality classes of in these kind of problems with large numbers of agents?
No, I mean, I guess what I would say is that the universality classes are like n is 1, you know, 1, 2, and infinity are the basic universality classes. You know, again, I would say the universality classes are easy, hard, impossible, and easy again as a function of n.
Yeah, but I mean, if you consider different problems of this type with large n, mm-hmm. Are they similar, like in some sense?
Yeah, but I mean, you have to tell me like what kind of problem you have in mind where n is changing, like what?
Yeah, so you explained to us several different kinds of problems,
right?
And like, is there each problem you had some observable, and we can consider this observable at large n,
right?
Is there a specific, like, similar scaling behaviors or universalities in observables at large n?
You know, not that I'm aware of, but I mean, I think maybe if we talked about, like, some specific examples, I might be able to say a bit more, but I'm not aware of, like, sort of a general universality classification as a function of n.
Okay. All right. Well, that was great. Thank you very much.